Ryan. Ryan is in his element. Ryan is finally good at something. He has in front of him, just like in the movies, a bigger corkboard that he ordered from supplies 3 days ago. It's 4 feet long by 3 feet tall. He doesn't yet have authority to put it up. It's resting against the wall, and Ryan is sitting cross-legged in front of it. He's been gathering his surveillance information for 2 months. He began by wheeling a TV into his cupboard. For hours, through bleary eyes, he reviewed the CCTV of the port, tape after tape after tape, evenings and weekends. He watched carefully, jotting down anybody who visited more than once, anybody who talked to Ezra, or who disappeared with him. Ryan made notes on post-its and then pinned them to the board. By the end of the month, he had a list of regulars. "Can you match these faces to any on the system?" he asked a passing analyst one Friday night. He pointed at the faces he'd freeze-framed and printed. "On it," the analyst said, just like that. And now he's got them, his foot soldiers. The undercover team had provided him with the names of the drug suppliers now, too. An undercover officer has infiltrated the gang. He went in as a test purchaser, dressed up scruffy, as Leo put it, asked for gear. The transaction went ahead, observed by Leo's team, and he reported back with the name of the dealer, who goes now onto Ryan's board. He did it 5 more times, 5 more test purchases, and then he said he'd moved house. He knew a few people who'd buy, wanted to trial supplying a patch. The dealer introduced him to the supplier, whose name also went onto Ryan's board. "Ryan," Leo says, striding into his cupboard, "you're a certified genius." This is the best job Ryan's ever had, the most fun, the most satisfying, and the most autonomous too. He feels a bubble of pride rise up through him, for him and his corkboard. "This is just the start," he says to Leo. "It's just part of the picture. The top guy has about 10 different ops running." They look at the corkboard together in silence. Leo says nothing for a minute, maybe more. One of the other officers walks past the cupboard. "Got a sec," he says to Leo, poking his head around the door. "No," Leo barks, closing the door. Life feels good when you're in Leo's sunlight. Terrible if you're in his shadow, like so many people in charge. "On our last job," Leo says thoughtfully, as though this exchange has not taken place, "the guy at the top was so unassuming, so normal, just normal, stayed under the radar, you know, didn't have a proper job, was self-employed, stayed under the tax threshold, didn't travel." "Seems impossible," Ryan says. "Right. Anyway, look at this, please," he says. "We have been creating a legend." He sits down creakily on the chair as Ryan unpins the various foot soldiers and moves them across. "Maybe we should get you a better office," he says through a laugh. "That'd be nice." "Okay, so, legends, ready for a lesson?" "Ready." When officers go undercover, they step into a persona that we have already created long ago, right? Okay. So, if someone was buying gear, the crims always suspect the DS, drug squad. So, we create a legend in advance. "He lives here. He drives this car. He works here. He does this." We have history, right? It goes anywhere we can get it, online, wherever. Then he steps into it. And so we are working on one now. He rubs at his jowls, then sips Ryan's tea, which offends Ryan, but he doesn't say anything. Leo does things like this when he's thinking, and Leo is brilliant when he's thinking, so everybody puts up with it. "Leo," Jamie says, pushing the door open. He looks harassed, his hair standing on end. "Got an issue." "What?" Leo is fiddling with one of Ryan's pins, which he shoves back into the board. "Can people stop fucking interrupt?" "Last night, 2 of the foot soldiers stole a car on one of the posh estates in Wallasey," Jamie says. "We've had a report in." "Okay. Rumour has it they thought it was one of the unoccupied houses they targeted, but it wasn't." Ryan swivels his head to look at Jamie. "There was a baby in the back of the car. They took it. The car is headed for the port with the baby in the back." Day minus 22, 1830. Jen is in her sanctuary, the office. She wanted to be here, at work, in this calm, organized environment she's fully in control of, or at least can pretend that she is. The knowledge that Kelly is involved keeps repeating on her. She feels like she's on a boat, the ground underfoot, uncertain and slippery. Kelly, her Kelly, the man she can tell anything to. But evidently that doesn't work both ways. How could he have pretended to work this through with her on that night that he believed her? The street down below is dotted with people shopping, enjoying the last of the summer warmth. Early October looks different to late. Gingerbread light outside, honey-coloured leaves, the last gasp of summer. She opens the window. Only the tiniest bite of cold laces the air, like a single drop of dye in water that will soon spread. She sighs and wanders down the corridor. She renovated the premises after her father died last spring. What was once his office, the plaque said managing partner like he wanted, is now in the kitchenette, a decision she made so she didn't have to look at his old door, or, worse, work in there herself. Her father had been a good lawyer, incisive, cautious, able to accept and confront bad news without kidding himself. Tough, she'd describe him as, with the hindsight of grief. Stoic, too. At the end of a working week once, she'd found out that he had slept there two nights to get the job done, and had never said. She is now much further back than she anticipated. Jen thinks her biggest fear is that she is going to pass the inception of the crime. She wishes she could ask her father what to do. Kenneth Charles Eagles. He'd gone by the name KC. If Jen and Kelly had had a daughter, they would have called her KC. KC. He'd have liked that. He'd died alone 18 months ago, an aneurysm, sometime in the evening. He'd sat in his armchair, a bag of peanuts and a bottle of half-drunk beer by his side. Jen, in the early days, had to turn her mind away from his last moments, like trying to steer a ship with a preference for one way only. She is more able to look at it now, to stand here in the spot where he once did, but today, more than ever, she misses him. He'd have no sympathy for time travel theories. She'd have been too afraid to tell him, she thinks, fearing judgment, but she still misses him in the way that children will always miss their parents' guiding hands. The way they can hold your problems away from you, if only temporarily. She makes a cup of tea, then leaves the kitchenette. Rakesh walks by her office with another lawyer, Sarah. The husband asked us to halve her maintenance budget to account for the fact that she only ever wears sweatpants. He's crossed off any allowance for clothing, plus haircuts and bras. He's annotated it to say she wears old greying underwear, Sarah is saying. Rakesh's disbelieving laughter rings out like a church bell. Jen smiles wanly. She's always felt so at home here with the workaholics and the gallows humour. She sends a few emails, happily passing on pieces of information, giving advice. The stuff she could do with her eyes closed, the things she's done for two decades. The soon-to-be ex-husband of one of Jen's clients couriers over 25 boxes off his accounts at 7 o'clock in the evening. Jen receives them from a jaded DPD driver with a t-shirt tan. Last time she'd stayed to start going through them, indexing their contents and stacking the boxes neatly in her office, Rakesh had poked his head around the door and asked if she was building a fort. He passes now, at the exact same time, but today, not wanting to sort boxes, but not wanting to go home either, she asks if he fancies a drink. "For sure," he says, chewing gum. "What's all this? You building a fort?" Jen smiles to herself. It's getting harder and harder to remember each day, the further she goes back. It's nice to hear her predictions come true, in a funny kind of way. "I will be on Monday," she says. "Disclosure from the other side, the husband's accounts." "What does he do? Work for the Bank of fucking England?" "Classic tactics," Jen says, shifting a box just so she can find a path to him. "Send so many boxes, he hopes nobody will ever look." I'll make sure you're not buried alive under it on Monday. I need wine in an IV, Rakesh says, grabbing her coat for her. Bad day. I send a petition off to my client today, to sign, nothing more, next to count four of unreasonable behaviour she's written in pen, also wanked into socks all the time. Like this was some urgent addition. I need to resend them to her now. We can't file that at court. A fair complaint, Jen says. Nice detail on the socks. You're not the one who has to see him at the trial. Don't follow him into the bathroom. As they leave, coats slung on arms in the now very, very early autumn, it's so nice to be back here, at work, where people spend some of the most intimate hours of their lives. She's worked with Rakesh for over a decade. She knows he eats potatoes most lunchtimes and gets bogged down in the Daily Mail website during his 3 o'clock slump. She knows he mouths, fuck off, whenever his phone rings, and that he once sweated through his own trousers during a particularly tricky hearing, says he left a mark on the chair. And so it's nice, too, tonight, to step out of the detritus of her family life, to leave the mystery and to innocently anticipate a glass of wine with her old friend, to discuss their clients warring over who fucked someone else first, to drink two glasses, no, three, to smoke cigarettes out in the beer garden and laugh about it. It's so, so very nice to pretend. Jen has had too much wine to drive, and so she walks home. It's just after 9 o'clock. She is weaving along the pavement, looking at her lit-up house just ahead, and thinking about her husband, who she has told she is working late. She's a divorce lawyer, she is thinking morosely, and yet she missed her own betrayal. Didn't see it coming whatsoever, not a bit. She tries to rejig the events into shape, knowing what she knows now. The wine has helped to loosen her mind. It feels elastic and free in the chilly night. For once she feels broad-minded and open, not neurotic and closed. The burner phone belongs to Kelly, so the missing baby poster and the police ID must belong to him too. But why were they in Todd's room? She hears voices as she approaches her house. They're coming from outside, somewhere in the open air. They're too loud to be inside. She stops by Kelly's car. It gives off some heat. She places a hand on the bonnet. Just been driven. The voices belong to her husband and son, the very subject of her thoughts. And they're yelling, urgent. They're in the back garden. Jen hurries as quietly as she can to the gate. She stops there, a finger on the cool black latch, immediately absolutely stone-cold sober. "Why have you told me this?" Todd says. Jen is disturbed to hear that his voice is laced with panicked tears. "Because I have to ask something of you," Kelly says. "All right, I wouldn't tell you otherwise." "What?" "You have to break up with Cleo." "What?" "You have to," Kelly says. "I can ask Nicola for help, but you cannot continue to see Cleo, given everything." Jen's stomach rolls over. She is suddenly nauseous, and it has nothing to do with the drink. "That will arouse even more suspicion," Todd says, "let alone fucking break my fucking heart." Jen feels like her knees are going to give way. The pain, the pain, the pain in her baby boy's voice. "I'm sorry," Kelly says. "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. How many times can I say it?" "This is the most fucked up thing that has ever happened to me," Todd says. Only he doesn't merely say it. It's a scream of anguish. Something thumps, a fist on the table, maybe. "I tried," Kelly says. His voice is hoarse, ragged at the edges with emotion. Jen has heard this side of him only a handful of times. Once in the station after Todd's arrest. No wonder, he's trying to stop it, and clearly doesn't manage. "I tried so hard. Joseph either knows or is about to find out, Todd, and we've got to extract ourselves from him without him knowing why." "Collateral be damned, right?" Todd says. "Me." Jen thinks of how Cleo wouldn't discuss the breakup with her, and wonders if somehow Todd has told Cleo something about this conversation, something he shouldn't have. "Right," Kelly says softly, and Jen wants to step away from her position at the gate, cold and alone, and go and shake her husband. "That was rhetorical," she'd say. Todd was not offering that up to you, you complete idiot. There is no indication that he knows, Todd says. The second he does, he will come here and he will... That's hypothetical. I can't believe you have involved me in this. Lies? Kidnapped kids? Jen's entire body goes still, covered in goosebumps. The baby. It's this or much, much worse, Kelly says, an inky black note to his voice. Oh yeah, keep it secret at all costs. Sail me and my first love up the river, Todd shouts. The back door slams, feet on stairs inside. Jen stays at the gate trying to breathe. It's pointless asking them. Clearly they will lie. And clearly too, there is a secret at the heart of their relationship that they will do anything to keep. They will do anything, except tell Jen. In the cool night air, 3 weeks before her son becomes a murderer, Jen hears her husband begin to cry in their garden, his sobs becoming quieter and quieter, like a wounded animal, slowly dying. Day minus 47, 08:30. A lot can happen in 3 weeks. It is the biggest jump back so far. 8:30 in the morning, day minus 47, nearly 7 weeks back in total. Jen stops at the picture window on her way downstairs. The street looks completely different. The sepia brown of late summer, grasses parched from lack of rain. The breeze against her arms is warm. She wonders what Andy would make of it. She went to bed last night with Kelly. He did an admirable job of acting normally. You wouldn't know anything had happened unless you'd overheard it. He'd been lying on their bed, hands behind his head, elbows out to the side, a caricature of a relaxed husband. Work good, he'd said. Full of documents. What did you do? Oh, you know, he had said. Shower, dinner, scintillating stuff. She remembers this line from last time. She had thought Kelly was just being dry, but sitting underneath his words last night was a kind of quivering fury, a man who had lost control of a situation. She'd gone to sleep next to him, her husband, the betrayer, because she didn't know what else to do. He'd spooned her, as he always did, his body warm. Once he was asleep, she'd looked at the skin on his arms. His, like hers, didn't look any different. But he was made of different stuff to what she had thought. And now it is 47 days back. She feels utterly alienated again, like she did in those first few days. She has pink nail polish on her toes that she remembers getting done halfway through August to see her through the final warm flip-flop days. It's mid-September, and what does she know? Kelly thinks Joseph is going to find something out, so he asks Todd to stop seeing Cleo. He does, but then gets back together with her. Kelly asks Nicola Williams for help. Nicola is injured, and then Joseph shows up, and Todd kills him. Jen knows more than she did, but in many ways it feels like less. It's so confusing. The doorbell goes, interrupting her thoughts. She checks the date again. Right. It's the first day back at school, Todd's first in year 13. She tries to spring herself back into action. Who's that? She calls. Cleo, Todd says. Jen leaps back from the window and into her bedroom. Did this happen last time? 8:30. She'd have left already, suited, booted, a typical weekday, latte in hand, divorces at the ready. But here, in the hub of family life, lies the secret. If he finds out, he'll come here. That's what Kelly said. I'll get it, Jen calls, even though she's in a tatty, an ancient pair of maternity shorts. Fucking hell, couldn't she have worn something nicer to bed back in September, and a t-shirt through which you can definitely see her boobs? She is going to answer that door. She pulls on a dressing gown and takes the stairs two at a time. Hi, Cleo says. And there she is. The woman her son has fallen in love with, breaks up with, gets back together with, is forced to leave by his father. The woman, surely, at the heart of it. Jen doesn't know what to ask first. Jen, right? Cleo says. She charmingly reaches out to shake Jen's hand. Her fingers are long and tanned from the summer, her grip loose, her skin dry but soft, still childlike. She looks otherwise the same as in October. That fringe, those huge eyes, the whites of them shining healthily. Yes, nice to meet you, Jen says. I don't start back until tomorrow, but I said I'd walk with Todd, Cleo explains. That's quite enough, Todd says. His backpack is over his shoulders, just like it was when he was 5, 8, 12. He too is tanned, much healthier looking than in October, less burdened. Jen can't stop looking at him, thinking of his tears last night, his fury. An explosive argument, and now this, a huge leap backwards. What does it mean? Kelly emerges out of the kitchen, but stops when he sees Jen. Are you off to work? He says to her. I didn't want to wake you. I think I'm sick, she says spontaneously. I turn my alarm off, throat like razor blades. Bunk off, sod the lawyers, Kelly says. An astounding lack of work ethic from the dad there, Todd commentates. Kelly turns his gaze to Todd. Work hard enough and one day you too can bunk off, he says. This phrase isn't what makes Jen stop, makes her wish she could press pause to absorb this moment. It's the look that passes between Kelly and Todd. Pure affection. There is nothing barbed under it whatsoever. Their eyes are alight. When was the last time she saw them interact like this? She can't remember. Todd reaches out to shove him, a mock shove. Jen's gaze lands on them. Throughout her entire career, she has always looked for the absence of things as well as their presence. Evidence is often in what people don't say, what they take out. The man who fiddles his accounts, trying to bury huge personal profit in 25 boxes of disclosure that he hopes the lawyers won't be bothered to go through. But she missed it at home. The lack of this easy banter, a clue in itself. That is why she's on this day, she thinks, to observe the contrast. The argument she overheard at the gate changed something for them, fractured it. And here she is before it. And don't things look completely different? Anyway, nice to meet you, Cleo says to Jen as Todd ushers her out. Nice to see you again, she adds, looking at Kelly. And it's this sentence that turns Jen's attention away from Cleo and on to Kelly. Her eyes meet her husband's as Todd closes the door behind him. She doesn't hear his car. They must be walking in the sun together. Nice to see you again, she asks him. Huh? He's turned away from her, is heading into the kitchen. She reaches out for him. It's legitimate, it's perfectly legitimate to ask this, why Cleo would say that to him, she tells herself. But why does she feel the need to think this way? She pauses. Because her husband can be evasive, comes the answer from somewhere deep within her. Have you met Cleo before? Yeah, she came for lunch with Todd one day. Did she? Only for about 5 minutes, think I interrogated her, he says, with a charming smile. She can tell he's thinking fast. You never said you'd met her? Kelly gives a laconic shrug. Didn't think it was important. But you knew it would be important to me, she says. She hardly ever challenges her husband in this way. She's always wanted to be, she doesn't know, easygoing, easy to live with. You know I've wondered what she's like. She almost adds that she knows he knows her uncle's friend. That later he asked Todd to stop seeing her, but she stops herself. He will only lie. She's nice, he says. The more she pushes, the more he dodges. She's never noticed before this quick-stepping of his, answering a different question, answering the original question. He goes into the kitchen and opens a can of Coke. The pop of the ring pull sounds like a gunshot, which makes her jump. Jen considers what to do, then gets dressed, pulling her trainers on. Going to get something for my throat, she calls. I'll go, Kelly says, considerate as ever. Or, wait, don't we have that stuff that... It's fine, she says, slamming the front door behind her before he can object. She drives to the school, then waits in a side street, watching for Todd and Cleo to appear. They do after only 5 minutes. Truman Show-like, holding hands, their long limbs catching the sun. Cleo is wearing a khaki boiler suit that Jem would look like a fat janitor in. Todd is in skinny jeans, no socks, trainers and a white t-shirt. They look like a wholesome advert for vitamins or something. Jen is going to offer Cleo a lift home and try to pretend she isn't insane for having followed them here. She waits for Cleo to see Todd in, but first, of course, they kiss. She shouldn't be looking, a creep in a car, but she can't stop. Their bodies are pressed together from their feet to their lips, right the way up, like somebody has sealed them. She watches for a second, thinking about Kelly. They still do kiss in this way, sometimes. He is good at that, maintaining their chemistry, holding her interest. But nevertheless, it isn't the same. When they finally part, Todd loping off with a smirk and a swagger, Jen leaves the side street and pulls up alongside Cleo. "I was passing," she says. "You want a lift?" Confusion crosses Cleo's features. "You're not on your way to work," she says. She has one foot on the pavement, one dangling off the curb, as she looks at Jen in indecision. God, Jen feels like some sort of evil perpetrator picking up her son's girlfriend. But 5 minutes in the car, where she can ask her anything, it's too tantalizing to pass up. "No, no, came to drop off something for Todd. Heading back now." "Well, sure," Cleo says happily. Jen is sort of glad to note that Cleo is an appeaser, just like Jen herself is. Cleo could easily draw a boundary here, but she doesn't. Instead, she gets in beside Jen. She smells of toothpaste. Perhaps Todd's, Jen thinks darkly, and deodorant. A wholesome sort of smell. She has the trousers of her boiler suit rolled up, revealing smooth, tan, slim ankles. Jen looks at them, feeling a wave of nostalgia for back then, whenever that is, some unknown time, when she went to pubs, when she kissed boys, when she was slim, never, when she had it all in front of her. "Where to?" Jen says. She doesn't explain her presence at the gate any further. In some ways, Jen is taking inspiration from her husband, who has been so good at lying that his secrets have been hidden in plain sight. There have been no over-explanations, no details at all, in fact, only a complete lack of them. The best kind of liar. The smartest. "It's Appleby Road," Cleo says. "A road behind Ishi Road North. Makes sense." "Oh, so you don't live at Ishi Road?" Jen asks lightly as she indicates and pulls away. "No, no," Cleo says, but she looks surprised that Jen knows her address. That's right, Jen has never been there. Is never supposed to have been there. "Just me and Mum at Appleby." Cleo doesn't elaborate, the same as last time. Jen glances quickly at her as she comes to stop at a roundabout. Their eyes meet for just a second. Cleo breaks contact, gets her phone out of her jeans pocket, angling her hips up to slide it out. "Kelly must think I live on Ishi Road," Cleo says with a laugh. Jen tries not to react. "Why?" "I'm always there, aren't I?" She pauses. "Kelly and Ezra and Joseph, they go way back, don't they?" "Right, right, yes," Jen says. "Sorry, so did Kelly introduce you to Todd then?" "Yes, exactly," she says. "Well, when I came with Joe to drop something off for Kelly, Todd answered the door and then..." "Has he never said?" "Do you know, Kelly has so many friends," Jen says, a sentence which is the exact opposite of the truth. "I plain forgot." Cleo turns her gaze to the left and looks out of the passenger window, not understanding the significance of the information she's imparted. Bewildered, Jen spends the rest of the trip in silence. She drops Cleo at her mother's house, who comes out onto the drive and waves at Jen. She looks nothing like Cleo. Cleo must look like her father, just like Todd does. 2 hours later, Jen is doing yoga for the first time in her entire life, a grotesque kind of downward dog in Kelly's car, her head underneath the seats, her arse somewhere near the neighbour's windows, it feels like. Jen needs to find the burner phone again, the one she now thinks belongs to Kelly. She wants to use it to call Nicola. And so this is what she's doing while he's out running. But there's nothing in his car. A few old coffee cups, a jack, an unopened bottle of Sprite. In a funny kind of way, she is glad he hasn't hidden the phone in here, under the seats, or with the spare tire in the boot. Kelly is never drawn to cliché, and she likes this, that he is not behaving exactly like every dishonest man before him, like she still knows him somewhere underneath the mess. She shakes her head and walks back into the house, where she continues her search. Tool bags, the airing cupboard, old coats, anywhere. He arrives back later, and she stops abruptly, trying to tidy away some of the mess she's made. While he showers, she grabs his regular phone and turns on Find My iPhone to track him. She'll have to do it every morning because she is travelling backwards in time, but so be it, she will do whatever it takes. It's 5 to 8 in the evening. Kelly and Jen haven't eaten yet. Jen is biding her time, waiting to confront Kelly about, well, everything, really. She's just working out what to start with. Todd is upstairs on his Xbox. Jen can hear the noises of his games playing out like thunder and lightning above them. Do you ever think he's getting a bit insular? Jen says. She's sitting on one of the bar stools while Kelly leans his elbows on the kitchen counter, looking at her. Nah, no way, he says. I was the same at his age. Computer games? Well, you know, I hate to break it to you, but he will be on porn sites. Kelly raises his hands, palms to Jen. It's so easy. How is it so easy to interact with him in this way? Their shared humour that they've always had. In the cafe, back on that first date, Kelly had been so quiet, so guarded, but by the end of the evening he had laughed her into bed. What, while the war rages on in Call of Duty? Of course, headphones in for the porn, Call of Duty on as a decoy. He gets up and turns to the cupboards, opening and closing them listlessly. We have no food. I've just lost my appetite. Oh, stop. It's perfectly natural, Jennifer. What, watching women with fake tits have fake orgasms? It taught me well. Kelly turns and raises an eyebrow at her, and despite everything, Jen feels her stomach burn. That dark little look, just for her. He's been a good husband, or so she had thought. Not exactly ambitious, somewhat unfulfilled at times, but interesting, layered, sexy. Isn't that what she always wanted? I could go for a curry, he adds, evidently thinking about food as she is deconstructing their marriage in her mind. She hears a phone vibrate, the kind of noise she would usually tune out. It's so ubiquitous in their house. Kelly unconsciously puts his hand to his front pocket, but as he turns, she sees that his iPhone is in his back pocket. She watches him closely. 2 phones, both on his body. She never would have noticed. Why would she? The burner phone is small, like a pebble. He wears his jeans loose, low-slung, always has. Jen draws her head back in a reverse nod, appraising him. Sure, she says. The Indian takeaway is a restaurant 3 streets up from theirs. They love it, even though it is expensive, perhaps because. It is entirely made of wooden cladding, like something from Centre Parks, and is beautifully lit. Jen and Kelly say they can never eat in there because the waiters have seen them pick up takeaway in loungewear, pyjamas, so often. I'll go, he says. Yes, this is right, isn't it? He went out, came home carrying joyous scented bags of Indian food. Had he been back later than she'd expected? She doesn't think so. God, not everything is a fucking clue, is it? I'll come. Nah, I'll go. You relax. Watch some porn, he throws over his shoulder as he leaves. She can hear him laughing as he opens the front door, as though nothing whatsoever is amiss. He's either taking a call or meeting someone. That's what Jen concludes. And so, right after he's left, she heads to the picture window to watch him go. She leaves the light off. She stands there, invisible, just watching him walk. Several houses down, somebody is waiting. Kelly raises a hand to him. Jen shifts so she can still watch them, so close to the window that her breath mists it up. She squints, trying to work out who it is. The sun has only recently set. Jen is much closer to summertime than she was yesterday. The sky is still silvery behind the black, shadowy houses. It helps to illuminate them. Jen sees Kelly clasp the man on the shoulder, the kind of gesture a teacher might make, a mentor, a therapist, or a very old friend. In an almost perfect echo of this night this all started, they turn around, and Jen sees that the person being greeted by Kelly is Joseph. They walk a couple of meters down the road, then Joseph says something. They stop, and a small bag passes from Joseph to Kelly, brown, about the size of Kelly's palm. He doesn't open it or look at its contents. He puts it in the pocket of his jeans, touches Joseph's shoulder again, then raises a hand behind him as he leaves. Joseph heads back, past their house. Jen shrinks to the side, to remain unseen. Joseph's eyes look up to the windows as he passes. Todd emerges from his room just as Jen is thinking it through, so all that talk about no food, that was groundwork being laid as carefully as an architect. Kelly was waiting for that phone to buzz, to signal Joseph's arrival. How sinister it is to relive your life backwards, to see things you hadn't at the time, to realise the horrible significance of events you had no idea were playing out around you, to uncover lies told by your husband. Jem would always have said Kelly was as straight as they come, but don't all good liars seem that way? Any danger of some food around here, or do I have to call social services? Todd says, coming up behind her. Do you know who that is? Jen says, pointing down to the street. This is surely better, actually, than asking Kelly. Todd is less connected to Joseph than she first thought, and is almost 2 months from killing him, and so maybe he won't lie. Todd squints. That's Cleo's uncle's mate's car. How does Dad know him? They were just talking. Todd shifts back from her, barely a step. Jen stares at him. But something significant has happened in his mind, but Jen has no idea what. Do they know each other? Jen asks again. They both look back down at the street. The dark is gathering. Her husband just performed some sort of transaction right there, so brazenly. Jen can feel the significance of this, of the argument Kelly and Todd go on to have, too. Information is rushing towards her. Perhaps an end is in sight. I need to know, she says to Todd. Look, I don't want to be causing marital issues here. Todd, you are not in a sitcom, Jen snaps. Amazingly, I do know that. Yes, Dad knows Cleo's uncle and his mate. Ask me not to tell you. Todd scuffs his bare foot on the carpet. What? Why? He says they're his old friends and you used to find them irritating and you wouldn't like that he got back in touch with them. He asked you to lie to me. Do you not find them irritating? I have no idea who they are. Jen is completely confused. In a few weeks' time, Kelly tells Todd that he can no longer see Cleo, can no longer associate with any of them. And yet, look, items passed under streetlights, trades willingly arranged on burner phones. Kelly has some association with Joseph. Cleo and Todd got together and complicated it, and Kelly thought it would fizzle out, that he could cover it up for long enough, and when it became apparent that he couldn't, he told Todd to end it. And why? That why is the missing piece. And Jen is fairly sure that today, Todd doesn't know why, only Kelly does. Todd holds his hands up. I don't know any more than that. Is Joseph trouble? Jen asks curiously, while her mind performs a firework display of questions. He might be a wheeler dealer, I don't know. He's a bit of a wide boy. How so? Todd turns his mouth down. I don't know. He doesn't work, but he has money. I really don't know. Does Cleo know more? No. I'll ask Dad. Jen grabs a jacket and shoves her feet into trainers, heads out into the mild, soupy night, summer's last exhale. She's glad to do this away from Todd. He already knows too much, clearly. She hurries along the street to the takeaway, feeling guilty about grilling Todd, feeling guilty in case he's worrying, feeling complicit in her hurt in some way. He's just a fucking kid. Of course he'd lie in order to keep his glamorous girlfriend. Jen's footsteps ring out as she half walks, half runs along the streets. The air is close, the sunset monochrome, rendered grey by cloud cover. The odd September leaf has fallen in the street. Brown, three-cloved, like a child's depiction. More and more and more will gather and fall, and she won't see any of them. Jen rounds the corner of the street that the takeaway is on and stops when she sees Kelly. He's got his back to her, is leaning on a street sign. His legs are crossed in front of him. He's on the phone. The burner phone she discovered in Todd's room in October. She registers now that that was after their row, so why did the phone end up in Todd's room? Does Todd take it from Kelly? "I've done it," he says, "so you're going to have to be in play too." Jen waits there, saying nothing. She walks a few silent paces back, hidden behind a corner, still able to hear. "I'll bring it to you. It's a spare key. It's on Mandolin Avenue, not far. I need to go now. Need to put in an appearance at home." That second sentence kills Jen more than the first. She gapes. There, her hands flat against a wall, while her entire world seems to spin off around her. She's about to charge at him, to ambush him, to yell when he says, "Thanks. Thanks, Nick." While Jen's lying husband emerges holding the takeaway, she collects herself. She needs to think. She wants to be sure she gains as much information as possible, rather than confronting him. His footsteps slow when he sees her. "Hey." His smile is easy but wary. He's no fool. He knows she knows something. "What's going on?" He immediately understands Jen, and he knows what a warning those questions are. "That phone call? Nick?" "No," he says, an educated guess. "You don't think..." "Show me your pockets." He looks once down the road, back at the Indian takeaway, then at his feet, a bite of his lip. Then he sets the takeaway down on the ground and does what she has asked. She walks towards him. Two phones and the brown package containing the key tumble out into Jen's hands. She says nothing, merely waiting for an explanation. This is my client's phone, Nicola, and her car." "Stop lying," Jen shouts. Her words echo around the street, bouncing back, distorted. Kelly's face slackens in shock. "You're lying to me," she says with a sob that she can't contain. For all her intentions, it has descended into the domestic she wanted to avoid. She can't help being emotional with him. He runs a hand through his hair, then turns on the spot. He's angry. "Burner phones and illegal transactions, Kelly." He doesn't say anything, just bites his lip and looks at her. "All right, yeah, the package, it isn't for a client's car." "Whose is it then?" He goes silent again. Kelly often allows pauses to expand, choosing to say nothing where other people would speak. Somebody else always talks first. But this time, Jen waits too, just looking at him across the quiet, dark street. His eyes run across her face. He's trying to figure out what she knows. He's trying to work out how to play his hand. "The card is stolen, but it isn't what you think," he eventually says. "What is it then?" "I can't say that." "Why?" He stops speaking again, staring down at his feet, evidently thinking. "What? Tell me, or we're in trouble, Kelly." She holds a hand up. "I am not joking." "I know perfectly well that you're not joking," he says tightly, "and neither am I. Tell me what the fuck is going on, or I go." He paces again, another useless circle that seems to serve only to burn off steam. "Jen, I..." His cheeks have gone red. She's getting to him, she can tell. Her husband may be calm, but even he has a limit. Just look what he did in the police station on that night that started everything. Just tell me who the key goes to. Just tell me who the guy was that you met just now. I'd tell you if I could. You don't want to tell me what you're mixed up in. It's as simple as that. You're giving me a fucking no-comment interview, Kel. It isn't even half as simple as that. I can't just stand by and have illegal shit happen outside the house. I know. Missing babies, stolen cars. Missing babies, he says. His eyes flash, then meet hers, his expression changing from irritation to panic. The missing baby. He pauses, breathing hard, then looks at her. If I say something, will you trust me on it? Jen spreads her arms wide right there in the street. Of course. Kelly comes over, grasping her shoulders urgently. Do not look into that baby. Nothing could have shocked Jen more than this sentence. What? Whatever you found, stop. Who's Joseph Jones? Do not look into Joseph Jones either, he says, his tone as vicious and as sharp as a snake's. They stand there in silence for a few seconds, Jen still in his arms. Kelly, you're asking me to just stop. Whatever it is you're doing, stop. Jen hates this tone of his. It provokes an ancient emotion in her. Her body wants to run. She wants to escape. Fear. Why? She says, barely a whisper. Kelly's fuse finally reaches its end. You're in danger, Jen, he says. She steps back from him in shock. Her shoulders are covered in goosebumps. She begins to shiver, feeling so alone. Who can she trust? Kelly looks at her. Behind the sorrow, she is sure she can make out an emotion on his features that she hasn't ever seen before on him, that she can't read. She tells him not to come home with her if he won't tell her anything else, and he doesn't. He leaves. She doesn't know where he goes, almost doesn't care. The takeaway bag sits there, its brown sides buffeting slightly in the wind. She picks it up and takes it home for Todd. For once, she has no appetite. Ryan. Ryan is loitering before the emergency briefing led by the sergeant Joanne Zamo. Leo, Jamie and Ryan are standing along the back wall of the briefing room. One for you, Jamie says right before Zamo starts speaking. OCG is Organised Crime Group. Thanks, Ryan says. I knew that. All right, Zamo says. She's in a trouser suit, flat black shoes, holding a coffee in her hand. Her weight is on one leg, and she's clearly thinking, staring at the floor, but probably at nothing, her brows lowered. Surveillance are feeding some stuff through to us now. Everybody ready? The briefing room is ablaze with adrenaline, in a way it isn't usually. A copper whose name Ryan doesn't know is erecting a board, pinning various items onto it. Two others are on the phone, talking more and more loudly. Okay, Zamo says. Surveillance have told us that the OCG were targeting an empty house. Then they saw a BMW idling on the driveway next door, keys in the ignition, engine on, so they took it. She folds her lips in on themselves, dimples appearing either side of her mouth. What they didn't know is it belonged to a new mother who was intending to go on a nighttime drive to get her baby daughter to sleep. She secured her in the car seat, then left her there for just a few seconds while she dashed in to get her phone. Something turns over in Ryan's chest. He can see it all. The panic, the terror, the woman seeing the car begin to move, rushing out after it, the 999 call. And now it's 5 hours post. The car hasn't been sighted, but we have eyes on the port where it was heading. Ryan thinks of that baby with criminals, or on a ship, in international waters, in the back seat of a car, alone. We have surveillance looking at AMPR for it, but we suspect they will have swapped the plates. We've put a stop on all ferries. Now let's find baby Eve. Leo throws Ryan a look he can't read. It's his job now, Ryan assumes, to go and get the names off his corkboard, and they're going to dispatch more surveillance officers to watch all of them to see if they can find the car and the baby. Ryan stares at the missing poster pinned to the board. He reaches a finger out to touch it. The paper feels soft and thin. The baby is beautiful. Ryan has always wanted children. Two, a boy and a girl. He knows that's so passé, but it's always how he's felt. Two kids and a woman who could make him laugh. Building his own family unit again, from the rubble of his upbringing. If those you've left behind don't stack up, create new people in front of you. She's 4 months old. She has the most beautiful eyes, like a soulful little lion, and it's his job to find her. All right, Ryan, Leo says an hour later. Sorry for the delay, been getting authorizations for more coverts. He sips his coffee. Ryan really wants that drink. He's so tired. He worries that he's beginning to prefer it, the station coffee, that he might start drinking from plastic cups at home. Where will they take the baby? Leo asks Ryan, in your opinion. The easiest place, they won't care what happens to her, the baby. Right, so, the port? They will fulfill the order, whatever that is, that's their priority. They might ditch the baby somewhere on the way. They won't take A roads or motorways because of AMPR. They'll go rural. That's what my brother would do, anyway, Ryan says, the words feeling like a betrayal to him. His older brother. He had always protected Ryan, sort of. But now look. The feds are always watching, he always used to say. You're an asset, Leo says, because of the brother thing, you know? Ryan shrugs, embarrassed now. I mean, there's no need for modesty, Leo says. He rises from the chair. My point being, you know this stuff, and yet you're here. You grew up there, he holds his left hand out, far apart from his side, and you arrived here. Thank you, Ryan says thickly. I mean, in some ways, Kelly taught me a lot. I guess the best criminals do. Day minus 60, 0800. Morning, beautiful, Kelly says. He walks into the bedroom, wearing only boxers. Jen startles. She could scream. The last day she spent with him, she left this man on the street. A domestic. A sinister, dark street corner. Betrayals. Crimes. Here, 13 days before, he is greeting her sleepily, his expression as friendly as the August sun outside. Morning, she murmurs, because she doesn't know what else to say. Stolen cars, stolen babies, dead policemen, don't look into Joseph Jones, don't try to find the baby, her son's anguished shouts in their back garden. And now this, Kelly here, topless, grinning at her. He doesn't miss a trick, stops getting dressed, jeans halfway up his thighs. What's up? No, nothing, gotta go in early. It's the trainee rotation day, she says, a fact she wasn't even aware of until she said it. The power of the subconscious. She knew immediately from 20 years in the law, the second she saw the date, that it was trainee changeover day. So what else does she know? Todd walks into their room too, and, God, the little things you never notice about living with somebody while they're growing up. He's maybe an inch shorter now than he is in October. Less broad, too, across the chest. He picks a bottle of perfume up from Jen's chest of drawers and sniffs it. Kelly pulls a t-shirt on. You look mental, Todd says dispassionately to Jen. You're poor trainee. Jen swats him away, but she doesn't mean it. She could stay here with him forever. And, she is ashamed to admit, with her husband. She could pause it all. Todd sniffing that perfume, Kelly with his head popping out of the neck of his t-shirt. Walk around them like they're statues. Love them. Just love them and never go forwards into the darkness and lies that await them, remaining here in blissful ignorance. Kelly showers and Jen checks his iPhone and turns back on location tracking as perfunctorily as she eats her breakfast. Some lawyers occasionally, during their careers, have moments of genius. Most of practicing law is mundane, form-filling, cost-budgeting, trying to extract everybody with the least damage done possible. But there are sometimes real lightbulb moments too, and Jen is having hers today. It is significant, it turns out, that it is trainee handover day, because here, in Jen's office, is a brand new trainee who does not know the name of Jen's husband. And on Find My iPhone, Kelly does not appear to be unblocking a chimney nearby, but is at the Grosvenor Hotel in Liverpool city centre. Jen's been trying to do the spying herself, but now she can send a trainee to do it for her. The one assigned to Jen is called Natalia. She is a classic solicitor in training, organised, overly cheerful, neat both in her work and in her appearance. Her hair is slicked back into a piece of elastic so perfectly that Jen takes a second in her sunlit office to marvel at it, like a horse's tail. Jen knows that Natalia's life will implode in early October. She will get home to find her boyfriend gone, packed up. He won't engage with her over it, practically ghosts her. She will tell Jen about it after several days of tearfulness and unproductivity. I have a task for you, Jen says. Her tone is probably too familiar, but she's worked with Natalia for 8 weeks already, having shared a pepperoni Domino's pizza while Natalia cried and said she hated Simon. And if her tone surprises Natalia, she masks it well. Jen pulls a photograph of her husband on her computer. She has surprisingly few. All right, this might be somewhat unorthodox, she says. Perfect, I'll do anything, Natalia says cheerfully. This man is in the Grosvenor Hotel right this minute, she says, pointing at her screen, presumably with somebody. We need to know what they're discussing. Natalia blinks. Even her eyelids are perfect. Jen knows this is a strange thing to notice, but nevertheless they are, smooth and painted with a colour just slightly lighter than her skin, enough to make her look alert and awake. Wow, okay, so, like surveillance on cheating spouses, Natalia says. Sure, Jen says lightly. Yes, she bolsters the lie. The court will be much easier on the wife if we can prove adultery. This is strictly legally correct, though Jen would never usually go to these lengths. Great. Natalia takes a pad and pen and goes to leave. If you have trouble finding him, call me, Jen says. Jen struggles to get any work done while Natalia is gone, which she supposes doesn't really matter. She undertakes useless filing and filling in of timesheets instead while she waits. Natalia arrives back at 1 o'clock, over 2 hours after Jen dispatched her. She is holding a blue legal pad and an eagle's pen bearing the logo that Jen's dad designed years ago. Her hair is still absolutely, completely immaculate. I bought a Coke. I hope that's okay, Natalia says. Jen feels a dart of guilt. God, this is a sordid task to give to a trainee on her first day, and she didn't even brief her on expenses. Oh my God, of course, Jen says. She gets a £10 note out of her purse and hands it to Natalia. Shouldn't I put it in the system? I am the system, Jen says crisply. Don't worry. All right, Natalia says, and Jen suddenly feels like some kind of psycho dispatching a completely new trainee to spy on her husband, the kind of desperate behaviour of somebody unhinged, somebody abusing their power. She pushes the thoughts away. It's for the greater good. Okay, Natalia goes on. He, Kelly, met a woman. He calls her Nick. I don't think they are having an affair, though. Nicola Williams. Again and again and again, even though she knows what she looks like, she still cannot find her online. No, it didn't look that way. It was a business meeting. Jen swallows. Right, she says. Shoot. They seem to be starting up some sort of arrangement again. It's hard to say what. Possibly working for someone called Joe? I don't know. Kelly doesn't want to do it. Nick wants him to. She seems to maybe think he owes her something. It sounded very loaded. I don't know. Okay, and Joe wasn't there? No, they kept saying he was inside, but I didn't really understand because they were inside. Natalia stopped speaking, her pen poised above the pad, leafing through it, flicking through pages and pages of immaculate notes. Fucking hell, Jen thinks. Natalia went to Oxford University, Marlborough College before that, and yet... inside? She doesn't know what that means? These kids. These naive kids. I think that's it. There was a lot of talk around what work they'd do for Joe, but no specifics mentioned, Natalia finishes. Inside. Jen holds a finger up and Googles Joseph Jones Prison. The information about him was there all along, hidden away among the common names. He was released last week from HMP Alt Course and was convicted 20 years ago in one of the largest trials of its type. Possession with intent to supply Class A drugs, conspiracy to rob, conspiracy to produce counterfeit currency, Section 18, grievous bodily harm with intent. The offences go on and on. Drugs, money laundering, robbing, stealing cars, burgling people's houses, violence. As many as there are droplets of mist outside when Todd murders him. Jen reads each while Natalia stands there in silence. She gradually becomes numb to them, to what this could possibly mean about her husband and for her son. "Thanks," she says softly to Natalia after a second. "Great job." "Shame he's not cheating," Natalia says. "If it would have helped, he actually mentioned how much he loved his wife." Jen turns away from her computer, and from Natalia too, staring out the window down at the street, her eyes wet. "Did he?" she whispers. "Yeah, just said he loved his wife. No context, really, in among all the Joe stuff." Jen nods, turning back to Natalia, wondering what would happen if she imparted some wisdom here, knowing, as she does, what faces Natalia in the future. But knowing the future is worse than not knowing, isn't it? Day minus 65, 17:05. Jen has been finding comfort in heading into the office on weekdays, undertaking piecemeal whatever tasks await her on that specific day. In September, she was doing financial investigations before a trial with Natalia, and into August, she has been drafting an advice on child protection, something slightly outside her remit, but enjoyable nevertheless, even though it disappears more with each day that passes. She has a trainee called Chance who leaves in September for a rival firm, which Jen does her best to forget now. At 5:05, her desk phone rings. "It's me, Valerie," their receptionist says. "There's someone in reception. I know, I know, I know you're harassed." Jen blinks. "Am I?" She doesn't feel remotely harassed. The child protection advice is half written. A hot cup of tea sits on her desk. She's looking forward to going home and seeing Todd, who's been baking cookies, sending her photographs of each flavour. She remembers that they are delicious, so she's extra excited. A little haven in her fucked-up backwards world. "Rakesh said you're on the child protection advice yesterday and today, I know." "Yes," Jen says faintly. She remembers this. The advice had taken her an embarrassing amount of time to get to. Weeks. The client had chased her twice, the second time asking if a simple note was beyond her. It was so hard, in law, to make the time to do large pieces of work. Phone calls, emails, unexpected and horrifying Outlook calendar appointments. Eventually, she blocked all calls to get to it. She'd even locked her office door. God, what a diva. "Who?" Jen says. "Who's in reception?" "Says he's called Mr. Jones." Jen's mouth goes dry. She wets her lips with her tongue. Look. Look what she missed. It's the 25th of August, and Joseph Jones is out and looking for her. Joseph turns in the pale carpeted foyer when he sees her. "Eagles" is written behind the reception desk in blocky lettering. The lights, on timers, have gone off, save for a single one, illuminating just him. "Looking for Kelly," he says. Jen pauses, her footsteps slowing as she crosses the foyer towards him. "Kelly Brotherhood," she says. Something seems to break across his features as he meets her eyes, but Jen isn't sure what. He's older than she first thought that first night, and the night she saw him at Ishii Road North. He's probably older than 50. Tattoos across the knuckles, eyes flinty, body language poised somehow, like a cat about to strike. He's light on his feet with it. "Yes," he holds both hands up. "He was an old friend." The knowledge is a physical feeling that shivers across her torso. Joseph's sentence was 20 years, so he must have known Kelly B. before it. What kind of friend? Jen can't resist saying, but inside she is thinking that Joseph, too, knows her. He knew to come to the law firm to find Kelly. Joseph smiles back at her, so fast as not to be genuine. An important one. Surprised you'd look here, she says. I've been away. No matter. Wanted to restart something. He turns away from her. He's in a white T-shirt, the material thin and cheap, and underneath it, Jen can make out a tattoo that spans the entire width of his back, and angel's wings right across his shoulder blades. Restart what? She says, but he ignores her, leaving the foyer door, shutting slowly behind him. Jen leans her hands on the reception desk, trying to breathe, trying to think. Joseph was released only days ago, and look, he's come here almost immediately. It's clear to Jen on this isolated day in this strange second-chance life that Joseph Jones's release from prison set something in motion. Somewhere in the future which she cannot reach at the moment, no matter how hard she tries. Something that involves almost everybody she knows. Todd, Kelly, and now her too, surely. Why else would he come to Eagles? A gruesome cast of dramatic personae, a hit list of betrayals.